Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldick. Well, this week, Kentucky Education Commissioner Terry Holliday served notice on Jefferson County public schools officials. If some of the district's low-performing schools don't show progress soon, they could be subject to a state takeover. And in an interview with the Courier-Journal, Holliday used the term academic genocide to describe the situation at some of these schools. Joining us now to talk about Holliday's remarks and the JCPS response is WFPL's education reporter, Devin Katayama. Welcome, Devin.
Thanks, Rick.
Well, this, I guess, all came up in a state progress report on low-achieving schools recently, right?
Yeah, last week, the Kentucky Board of Education heard a progress report from an associate commissioner, Susan Allred, who was basically just updating the state on the 41 priority schools, formerly known as persistently low-achieving, as defined by certain state metrics. In that, Holliday asked if there's a region or an area or a district that was performing really low. And she said, yes, of course, Jefferson. There's a few reasons for that. One, it's a big county. She was also saying that the change in leadership with Superintendent Donna Hargens could be a reason. But she also stated some concerns, such as some of the schools weren't following their recovery plans, and the state wasn't doing a good job of really keeping track of those schools. Of the 41 priority schools statewide, there are 18 in Jefferson County. 16 of those were not making adequate progress, according to the state. So that's obviously a really big concern to JCPS. And they knew that they weren't making this progress, but this was the first time we really heard it publicly in front of the board.
Are these mostly high schools?
High schools, middle schools, oddly enough, a lot of high schools are listed as persistently low-achieving schools. The two schools that did make adequate progress were both Fern Creek and Fairdale, which are both high schools. So it's hard to determine which schools are really performing. You know, you can't really compare high school with an elementary school as easily as you can against each other. But we do have a fair amount of middle schools that are also in the bunch.
You get this designation of being low-achieving or low-performing. This makes you eligible for some funds, right?
It does. And, I mean, there's three different cohorts that were listed, three different groups of schools that were listed over the past few years. The first cohort got a certain amount of money. The second cohort got the most. The third cohort got no funding, which is a big concern. But they did say that the latest cohort did learn some things from the previous two. And then, of course, Mr. Holliday made that comment to the Courier-Journal about academic genocide, which really upset a lot of community members. And the school board meeting this week, you really saw that with some people that spoke, and they talked about issues such as busing. They talked about lower performing teachers in some of these schools. They said it's really a community issue, which you also heard from some of the school board members. And you saw school board members like Debbie Westland who were really concerned about teachers maybe not speaking up. And here's a clip from her.
So I guess I'm just expressing just a real concern that we're doing everything we can and that you all have a safe place, Dr. Hargens, that our staff, because there are a lot of things you hear that nobody's comfortable in saying really publicly or to their superiors. And we've got to have a safe place for people to say, this is what we need to do. This is what this board, whether we want to hear it or not, if there's something we've said is your policy that is inhibiting you from being successful, because you're the ones on the hot seat, you know. We may get not reelected, but that's not that big a deal. But your jobs are big deals, and I want to support you. I'd like to see all of you be successful.
One of the more interesting interactions of Monday night's school board meeting was a newly elected school board member, David Jones Jr. He addressed Hargens, and he said simply this.
And I guess I'm going to have to turn to Dr. Hargens and say, what is our overall response? Not dueling data, but how are we doing? I mean, what do we need to focus on here when somebody uses those words to describe what's going on here?
Well, and actually, we have a great sense of urgency in Jefferson County Public Schools. There's not a principal out there that isn't urgent because they know the stakes are high. They know that we are the key to students' academic future and success. So what I would frame it that way is that there is no greater challenge or greater job on this planet, I guess, than to impact a student life, a student's lives, and to change their lives forever. So that is really so I sense it with these principals. I sense it when I visit schools. They know that, and I think Principal Stroud said it. We're even on a bad day, we're what students have, and we're going to be the key to their success. So I think all of the emotion is built around an incredible sense of urgency and importance about what we do. But we're all working hard every day together, and I think it's a collaboration. So it really is a collaboration that will get us there. But that's how I would frame it, maybe in a different way.
So you heard her answer there, and it wasn't as clear as maybe Mr. Jones would have liked, or maybe the community would have liked. That's because these issues are very difficult to tackle, and you saw that. I mean, Mr. Holliday came to the Courier-Journal editorial board after he made those comments. Obviously, that's a big move on the Kentucky Department of Education's part, and also Susan Allred accompanied him to kind of talk about why he used that phrase, academic genocide. And even when Holliday was asked, you know, what would you do if you were here? What would you do if the state could take over some of these schools or manage them in certain ways? And Mr. Holliday started talking about certain targets that the state, you know, applies and the schools must meet. But he stops for a second and then he says simply, well, we're all they've got. We're the last thing that they have. Other than that, it's federal government, which, you know, doesn't happen. But he was saying that's not an option. So he was kind of short of answers or short of ways to kind of turn around these schools.
I guess some would ask, and there are a lot of schools in Jefferson County, and some are in better, more economically deprived neighborhoods than others. I guess maybe that's one reason. But there are so many outstanding schools in Jefferson County. I have a son in one of the traditional schools, which is just terrific. And some would ask, well, why the imbalance?
Sure. And this is something that you heard, I believe, at the school board meeting. You saw some principals who were there who were talking about their turnaround efforts. Of course, Mr. Holliday was saying, well, were there principals that weren't doing as well or their schools weren't performing as well? But that's the key. I mean, there's a lot of schools that haven't been identified as persistently low achieving that are still struggling. And how do you get resources or how to get best practices into these schools? And that's what the school district's trying to tackle.
Okay, we're going to bring another voice in on this to give a better understanding of the district's low-performing schools. Devin spoke with University of Louisville professor Craig Hochbein. He co-authored an article that will be released later this year. His team looks at how persistently low-achieving schools, now called priority schools, were identified, and they raise the question of whether the right resources are going to the right schools. Hochbein says the lowest-achieving label has been disproportionately assigned to high schools based on AYP, or adequate yearly progress, schools are expected to meet.
This idea came from a student who was sitting in class who said, why are there so many high schools being identified and why are there so many being identified in Jefferson County specifically, which is an interesting question. So when you looked at the population of schools, you realize that about 60% of the population of schools are elementary schools. So whenever you identify low-performing schools, we would logically assume that approximately 60% would be elementary schools. And when you delve further into this, it has to do with the use of the AYP metric, because AYP, like I said, is sensitive to population size and diversity. So the larger a school gets, the more likely it's going to have more students who fulfill these what are called subcategories. And what ended up happening is that when you look at elementary schools, they had fewer AYP metrics to meet, on average, about two fewer than middle or high schools.
And let's really quickly talk about some of those metrics, for example.
So it would be, when you looked at it, you would have to have not only the number of students proficient, but No Child Left Behind mandated that we looked at the number of disadvantaged students who were proficient, the number of Latino students who were proficient, the number of men who were proficient, the number of women who were proficient. And so you can imagine that creates this slate of adequate yearly progress checkboxes almost. And when you have enough to populate one of those fields, you then have to meet that goal. And so high schools were being held responsible for meeting more goals than elementary schools. You know, obviously they have to meet them, and we're not saying they shouldn't meet them and that elementary schools shouldn't meet them. But what we're saying is high schools essentially had to do more in some ways. You know, if you were asked to do a task and you were said you have to do, would you prefer to do seven tasks perfectly or 12 tasks perfectly, I think you would say, I'd rather do 7, increasing your likelihood of success.
So 10 of our 18 persistently low achieving, which we now call priority schools in JCPS, are high schools. We put a lot of pressure on PLA schools,
sure,
and we're throwing a lot of resources at these PLA schools. But what's important for the community to know about, first off, are these schools the only schools that are performing at this level, and were they rightly identified, I guess is the case. And it sounds like they might not have been.
It's not as if competent and well-prepared students were showing up at the high schools as freshmen and the high schools were doing a disservice to them. There's no real evidence of that. And especially that's one of the things that we found is that, and other researchers have found across the country, is that the performance of high school students can be predicted as far back as 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade. So we know something about the performance of high school students based upon their performance in elementary schools. And what type of interventions are we providing to those schools that feed these high schools? So there need to be reform in these schools, but it's a much larger conversation than just potentially that single school. And again, in a district like Jefferson County, where you have school choice and perceptions and that type of thing, being labeled as a persistently low-achieving school can be incredibly damaging to the reputation of a school and the willingness of a parent to send their child there.
Who needs to be at the table? Who needs to be in these discussions? Obviously, people have been doing this research, which I'm sure the Kentucky Department of Education has mm-hmm. its own researchers and maybe even reaches out occasionally to other mm-hmm. folks. But I'm curious what needs to happen in order to really improve that system or to shine light on what's really going on.
Again, these are complex answers, and some of that deals with the idea of what approach do you want to take to improving. So, for example, there are areas in which, and there's some evidence of this, that a more well-rounded approach, which includes providing mental health services, which include dental, medical. There's an article in the Atlantic Monthly that talks about a school in the Lehigh Valley area in which they've done this, and they have what are sort of called wraparound services for students. So you can imagine if you're going to provide that type of level of service, you need to have a lot of people around the table. I noticed the commissioner referenced Montgomery County in Maryland in his discussions. Well, they had a housing policy that has facilitated some of the improvement in disadvantaged students' achievement.
And that's essentially a voucher system for disadvantaged families.
Yes, they have sort of a lottery system in which you receive their Section 8 housing. And so a woman by the name of Heather Schwartz has done a wonderful study that looked at student improvement over time. And there was improvement, and she was attributing it a lot to, you know, the title of her article is Housing Policy is School Policy. And so if you would go that route, which has demonstrated some success in other places, you have to likely have people from the mayor's office around that table talking about housing policy, talking about where will new housing be built up, how much will be left behind for disadvantaged students, and those types of issues.
Thank you so much for taking the time mm-hmm. to join us.
Thank you.
That's University of Louisville Professor Craig Hochbein talking education with WFPL's Devin Katayama. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. The Kentucky General Assembly's short 30-day session continues in Frankfort, and here with an update on what's been a busy week at the Capitol is Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Welcome back. Let's start with the industrial hemp bill, why don't we? The measure cleared the state Senate yesterday. It's aimed at creating a hemp industry in Kentucky. Although it looks like it faces an uncertain future elsewhere, there's been a lot of high-profile support for the measure, and polling seems to indicate the public's behind it, but it looks like not everyone is on board.
You're exactly right, Rick. Notably, Governor Steve Beshear has not signaled his support yet, even went as far to say that it was kind of a marginal industry yesterday when he was talking to reporters and was asked about this poll. Of course, that poll shows, 65% of Kentuckians favor hemp legislation, thinking that it will help create jobs in the Commonwealth. Only 16% really cared about whether or not law enforcement's claim that it could, have a spike in illegal marijuana use or hurt their eradication efforts when it comes to marijuana. And so the governor really didn't bite that, on that at all, said law enforcement concerns still play, the bigger role. And House Speaker Greg Stumbo also has really trashed the legislation, saying that, once again, that it's marginal, that it really won't create jobs, and he thinks that it should be studied more if anything at all happens with the bill.
Now, parallel to all this, something has to happen on the federal level, right? Doesn't Kentucky need to get a waiver or something like that in order to grow industrial hemp?
That's right. One or two things have to happen. For, you know, either a waiver, like you said, which Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell have expressed that they might be interested in, asking the president for, or the DEA for, if this bill passes on the local level, or they could actually pass legislation themselves, which, of course, Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell have sponsored legislation that would make hemp a legalized drug and no longer lump it with marijuana and some other illegal plants. And so those are the main options that they have at their disposal.
So just to review, it cleared this, the state Senate this week, and now the measure will go to the House Agriculture Committee?
That's right. Speaker Stumbo says that he will put it to the House Agriculture Committee, when the bill officially comes over. It did pass the state Senate by a rather large margin this week. And when it gets to the House Committee, it's likely to be changed into a study looking at hemp instead of the actual bill regulating farmers who want to grow hemp. So, just the fact that it's going to committee doesn't give it extra life. If anything, it probably signals that it will be changed. And once it's changed, I guess the question is, does Commissioner Comer and hemp supporters go with that study just to keep the ball rolling, or do they reject that and is the issue dead?
Also this week, a statewide smoking ban. There was a big rally in Frankfort, wasn't there?
That's correct. This is the third year that they've offered a statewide smoking ban bill. Susan Westrom is the sponsor of that, and they've gotten some high-profile help. This year they brought along former UK basketball player Derek Anderson, who is well-known, grew up in Louisville, actually, who made a lot of Louisville fan jokes because it was on Valentine's Day. Supporters of Smoke Free Kentucky have taken to wearing red for women's health. And he joked that it looked like he thought he was at something with a lot of UofL fans, but turns out it was the Smoke Free rally. Governor Steve Beshear is supportive of the legislation. So there's a lot of different people who are really coalescing behind this issue. Unfortunately, how it goes in Frankfort is there's not always that cooperation on the across the other side of the building, and the bill does have issues in the state Senate where at least two members of leadership say that they are not in favor of the bill.
And also, I think we check in on this every time we talk to you, but the dropout bill that would raise the dropout age is also advancing.
That's right. It has passed the House once again, and the Senate for the second year in a row is advancing its own dropout bill that would basically make it a county board of school board decision, not on a statewide level. Supporters of both sides of both pieces of legislation seem to be optimistic that, they could come to a compromise this year. There was thought that there might be compromise on this issue at the end of last legislative session, and the fact that they're coming back and still seem optimistic means that, one of the governor's chief priorities, which is that dropout bill, could be passed in one form or the other. It just depends on how they're going to, I guess, the House and the Senate, how they're going to take their two bills and try to make them meld.
Listening to Byline on WFPL, we're talking with Kentucky Public Radio's Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Kenny, there was a dust-up, a political dust-up this week in the state Senate on a nursing home bill. What was that about?
Right. Basically, this bill would set up what's called medical review panels in nursing home abuse cases. It's something the nursing homes have really pushed for because they say Kentucky has a really bad the environment is really bad for nursing homes when it comes to frivolous legislation. Of course, there's a lot of people that say that's far from the truth, that a lot of Kentucky nursing homes are bad actors. And lawyers aren't just coming in willy-nilly from out of state to sue these nursing homes. Regardless of the arguments, the bill ended up passing the state Senate this week after a lot of hot debate from Senator Ray Jones, who's a Democrat who did not support the bill. He, you know, showed a lot of pictures of nursing home abuse cases, had a lot of people tell stories about their relatives that were abused. But at the end of the day, supporters say there's no jury caps, there's no limitations, that the panel would be made up of doctors, and that, you know, lawsuits could still go on even if the bill becomes law. But opponents of the bill ended up saying that they were taking solace in the fact that the House is likely to kill the bill and that it's dead on arrival. So whether or not that's true, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But that was something that kept opponents, I guess, a little warm during the discussion.
We also saw another commemoration of I Love Mountains Day this week. Hundreds of people gathering, speaking on the Capitol steps, of course, against the coal extraction practice of mountaintop removal. Is there any legislation pending in this session that addresses that?
Well, there's always legislation that, you know, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth have that basically, you know, try to end or reduce mountaintop removal somehow. The problem is that they can't really get much support from it. There's a lot of people in the General Assembly who say they support coal, that they support the jobs that coal brings to the Commonwealth. So there's always bills, but they haven't been successful yet. Of course, they're optimistic, as they usually are. But at the end of the day, you know, unless leadership changes or something, you know, I guess out of the blue happens, the chances of a bill like that passing are very slim.
And finally, before we talk about the local option sales tax, with Philip Bailey is joining us here, I do want to bring up that the alcohol sales on Election Day bill is advancing as well.
That's right. There, you know, the Senate has really made that a priority to allow alcohol sales on Election Day. I believe Kentucky and South Carolina are the only states that still don't allow that. And so the question is whether it actually can get through the House in a short session. Generally, it has not. There's still concerns that people would buy boats with alcohol. But, you know, the arguments are is that Kentucky's Bourbon Trail, which is one of the, I guess, one of the landmarks in the state, tourist attractions, you know, they have to close on Election Day. They can't have their tours where they give out samples or where you can buy alcohol at their distilleries. You know, a lot of bars and liquor stores and everything else close. And so supporters are really pitching this as kind of an economic thing. You know, we're shutting down our main tourist attraction. We're robbing ourselves of a lot of dollars economically and our businesses. And we just really need to do this. That they argue that, you know, people really don't buy votes through alcohol anymore. So the interesting thing is whether or not it can get through the House. At the same time, the House is advancing a bill that would ban wine and liquor from grocery stores, and of course there's a court case on that that is ongoing in federal court. So both chambers have dueling, I guess, alcohol legislation, and we'll have to see whether they try to compromise or can pass them cleanly.
All right, another piece of legislation introduced in Frankfort would set the wheels in motion for a local option sales tax. We've been talking about this quite a bit. It would allow municipalities to ask voters to approve a temporary sales tax hike to pay for special projects. And, of course, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher is among its proponents. And joining Kenny and me to talk about it is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Hi, Philip.
Hey, Rick.
Good to have you here. Well, let me start with you, Kenny. It looks like legislative leaders are not exactly crazy about this idea.
No, they're not. Both House Speaker Greg Stumbo and Senate President Robert Stivers have basically said that they're not interested in this proposal. Stumbo, because he said there's other things that cities and communities can do in order to, I guess, raise taxes or raise revenue, and that, you know, he wasn't really fond of using the sales tax for local projects because that is one of the things that the state relies heavily on when it comes to their general fund. So he said they usually try to keep those two things separate, wasn't a big fan of the proposal, would like to see other things. And Senate President Robert Stivers basically said that, you know, his chamber was not in favor of letting, you know, additional taxes on the individual. They would rather see things that brought in tax base, that brought in jobs, and collect more revenue that way.
And Philip Mayor Fisher, as we mentioned, has been kind of the point person on this, and he says this would be a great way to really fund some special projects.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to Mayor Fisher's rhetoric on this, he's the chief cheerleader for it. He associates it, you know, with freedom. I believe in his rally in Frankfurt this week, where he was joined by Mayor Gray, he said, you know, this is about freedom. Who could be against freedom and democracy? At the same time, it's an uphill battle for the mayor. Obviously, both Speaker Stumbo and President Stivers are opposed to the legislation, opposed to the idea. It doesn't seem that Fisher is working with State Senator Kathy Stein, who has introduced legislation that would create a local option sales tax. He's saying he's going to draft his own. So when you ask the mayor, who's the chief cheerleader for local option sales tax, he's very vague and open-ended about democracy, freedom, but not very specific on the details of what a local option sales tax in his view would be.
I wonder, and I'm not trying to throw cold water on anything, and this would be a lot different, but I remember a few years ago we had the library tax proposal where voters said capital N, capital O, and please don't ask me again. And so, you know, I'm just wondering how much enthusiasm there would be here.
Well, that's Mayor Fisher's point, that he said, you know, the mayor said, I'm not saying we should have a tax increase. Uh-huh. I just want the residents to be able to make those decisions periodically, whether it's on the libraries, whether it's on a forensic lab, whether it's on road repairs, whatever it might be. The mayor continuously says, this is about choice. However, at the end of the day, the question is, what goal or what effort is the mayor's office putting into getting this passed? For example, Stein's bill, details came about it this week, and one of the things in her legislation, the referendum would actually say that the state would share some of the revenue. In some cities and some places where there is a local option sales tax, the state gets a cut of whatever extra revenue is raised from a local option sales tax. I haven't heard this mayor say that he's in favor of something like that. But that's what's on the books right now. So as we go along more and more with this, I think that this will force Fisher to be more specific about what he wants a local option sales tax to be.
And Kenny, are there other mayors from around the state that are as enthusiastic about this as Mayor Fisher?
There are a few that are pretty enthusiastic about it. You know, county judge executives and mayors in Hardin County, in the Owensboro area, I believe also in Northern Kentucky, all came out and supported, also Bowling Green, supported Mayor Fisher and Gray in a rally this week that Philip was talking about. And they say they really need this for infrastructure improvements. Of course, some of those guys are, you know, they're not just Democrats. A few of those are Republicans as well. But what really seems to be an issue here is the General Assembly kind of likes to have control of tax revenue and infrastructure projects, across the state, including in Louisville and Lexington and other areas. And the local option sales tax would clearly take a lot of that power out of their hand on a, you know, bi-yearly basis. And so I think that plays a little bit into it, too, that lawmakers aren't quite ready to just, you know, give cities or communities free rein over whether they can raise taxes or lower taxes and what they spend all of their money on.
All right. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. Kenny, we'll let you get back to work in Frankfort.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, here in the Louisville Metro Council, a proposal that would raise the tax insurance premium in the city to bolster the Affordable Housing Trust Fund appears to be all but dead. All 9 council Republicans opposed the measure, and now 5 Democrats are saying they won't vote for it. And Philip Bailey is here with us to talk about it some more. First of all, Philip, just for background, what is the Affordable Housing Trust Fund and why does it need money?
Well, the Affordable Housing Trust Fund was started in 2008. Its initiatives are aimed at different affordable housing initiatives. It's got its own board. It has an executive director. It's something that many feel really passionate about. They address issues like, for example, that, you know, 92,000 Louisvillians, a report found, can't afford their rent or mortgage. You have a skyrocketing number of homeless children in Jefferson County Public Schools. I believe Devin has reported on that extensively. So there are these issues with the lack of affordable housing. And they also say that we need about 58,000 new units in affordable housing of some sort. So this has been something that has struggled, however, to find a consistent revenue stream, because when the council created it back in 2008, the goal was to have $10 million in it annually.
And this would be a 1% hike on the insurance premium tax, and it would affect everyone in the Louisville metro area?
No, it would not. If you live in an incorporated city like Shively, Seneca Gardens, or Hirschborn, you have your own insurance premium tax that your city has, which in some cases is actually higher than the 5% that Louisville charges. So it wouldn't apply to everyone. Critics also say, Council Republicans in the main, that this 1% tax increase would actually be a 20% increase on the premium itself. Mm-hmm. Now, housing advocates shoot back and say, listen, that's only about $1.25 for the average resident. It's really hard to say on average what it would be because you and I might have different driveways, Rick. You might have a car or a boat or a life insurance policy or a fire insurance policy that I might not have. So there's some disagreement there, but clearly the political wind is not in favor of this legislation and thus far.
And you went to the Metro Council meeting last night, and there were some people there, of course, talking about it. Listen to that.
Since 2008, the housing crisis, of course, has continued to degrade our city. It's created thousands of additional vacant and abandoned properties.
One in four homes are boarded up. Children live on that street. Elderly people live there who used to be proud of their neighborhood.
You get a single mom trying to keep her kids in school. She is working at McDonald's. She's working the office job in the daytime. She may have a 12 or a 13-year-old who is babysitting the younger siblings. She is not a deadbeat. She is not lazy.
In my lifetime, I've dealt with slumlords. You never see them. They come out. They sell you this rented place. It's horrible. I've lived with insects I've never even seen before. National Geographic can't even explain them. I've had a ceiling in my bathroom fall in.
This is a crisis in our city, and with any crisis comes somebody who's going to take advantage of it.
Well, in your lease, well, when you signed, those are the excuses that they give. And for someone who's educated, that's fine, but there's a lot of people who do not understand how to read their leases.
The families change their lives. They change them instantly. They are successful once they get stable housing.
We need to be compassionate for those people who we see every day who are holding two or three jobs and still cannot find affordable housing.
The city should get this money in the door, and it should address the needs of housing. And the trust fund that you've established is the best way to address those needs. Thank you.
So, Philip, this tax proposal, there are 26 Metro Council members, 9 Republicans say no, and now 5 Democrats say they won't vote for it.
Yes, because you had 3 of the original co-sponsors, Councilwoman Madonna Flood, Councilman Blackwell, Councilman Ackerson now last night, saying that they no longer sponsor the legislation, that they're opposed to it. And Council President Jim King now also says he's against it. So at this point, you have 14 against, and even if the 4 remaining co-sponsors get some support, that's still not enough. So this law may have to be changed significantly for it to have any chance in the council.
All right, we'll be keeping an eye on it. WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL. Hundreds of thousands of square feet of office space in downtown Louisville sit vacant. The 26-story Meidinger Tower at 4th and Muhammad Ali is almost half vacant, and the building is in foreclosure. What's going on? Here to talk about it and answer that question is the Courier-Journal's Chris Ott, who's been reporting on it this week. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rick.
Welcome
Thank you.
Back to the program. Well, you write that not only is the Meidinger Tower, and am I saying that right, is it Meidinger?
Yeah, that's what I've heard, yes. I've heard a couple of different ways to pronounce it, but that's the way it sounds in my head, at least.
I've worked down the block for almost 12 years, and that's how I've been saying it. Well, it's almost half empty, plus the Aegon Center is 1/4 vacant, the Brown & Williamson Tower 30% vacant, and 14% of the PNC Plaza is open. Is this a lingering effect of the recession, or are companies just finding other places to go?
Well, it's more an effect of corporate downsizings, relocations, some moves to the suburbs. It's just kind of a confluence of things that have opened up this vacancy.
We also understand that I think you reported that Humana is going to be moving some of its staff from downtown to the East End.
Yes, they have a government division of their company, which they're going to consolidate in one location in the Forum Office Park in eastern Jefferson County. And that is going to move about 750 Humana workers out of downtown. And they're going to be making that move this spring. And it should be complete, I believe, in the third quarter of the year.
So we have all this empty space. What are city officials and the real estate folks planning to do about it?
Well, you know, there are varying degrees of alarm and concern about this. City officials that I talked to said they're kind of kicking around the idea of a public-private partnership, although the details are not at all worked out. It's not decided by any means, but the idea would be maybe some sort of incentive program to help the owners of these buildings rehab their space and bring it up to date, make it more attractive for leases. You know, there's some concern that if more of these buildings fall into foreclosure, you know, that really is going to affect property values downtown, and they're going to be able to appeal their assessments. And, you know, you get tremendous tax bills from those from those properties, and as well as everyone believes that a strong downtown is crucial for a strong city. So there is some concern there. There's also some positive ways to look at it, according to the agents and officials that I talked to. For one thing, there's a whole lot of opportunity. If Louisville were to land, you know, a big corporate headquarters or something like that, they can say, hey, look, we can have all this contiguous space downtown where we've got new restaurants and we've got the KFC Yum Center. It's really a really vibrant place, a great place to work. And then there's also going to be some economic realities that are going to come into play when companies are looking. For example, you know, the suburban space is getting tight, particularly for a big block of space. And so and prices downtown are going to be feeling pressure. So you may have some natural migration to downtown just because there aren't any other options.
And I guess there would be concern about regular housing downtown, the impact it would have on, unless folks want to drive from downtown and commute to the suburbs to work.
Sure. Well, I mean, housing and retail are two of the pieces that city officials say if we can build up those two things, that will also increase the vibrancy of downtown and make it an attractive place where companies are going to want to locate and young workers are going to want to have their offices down there as opposed to an office park.
As we mentioned, the most glaring example of this is the Meidinger Tower, and you looked into its status.
Yes.
Where does its foreclosure case stand right now?
Well, it's at the commissioner's office, and normally, you know, if I were looking at this a homeowner's case, which I've looked at a lot, you would think that, and this is definitely headed for the judicial auction block. However, with loans this big, this is a $25 million loan. Oftentimes, these court battles are just part of a broader negotiation about, you know, how to restructure the debt. And the Chicago-based owner of the building told me that they are working to get back in line with their lender, get things squared away. So until the lender actually moves to get that property on the sale calendar, you're not sure whether it's actually going to be auctioned in court or not.
All right. You can hear Chris Ott's reporting on the glut of office space in downtown Louisville in the Courier Journal at courier-journal.com. Chris, thanks for joining
us. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and it is time for our arts segment with WFPL's Aaron Keene. And Aaron, we have a lot to talk about today.
We sure do, Rick.
Let's start with Kentucky's new poet laureate. The announcement came down yesterday.
That's Frank X. Walker. He is a Danville native, teaches at the University of Kentucky, a graduate of Louisville's Spalding University MFA program. Frank is a fantastic poet. He's also the first African-American Kentucky poet laureate. And at 51 years old, he's the youngest.
And he, as you mentioned, is an instructor at the University of Kentucky. We got some reaction from him from one of our sister stations in the Kentucky Public Radio Network. Says he's ready to get moving on this and looking forward to his tenure. This is a 1-year appointment.
This is it's a 2-year appointment. He'll run through the end of 2014. He'll be formally inducted at a ceremony in the Capitol on April 24th, which is Kentucky Writers' Day. Frank is well lauded across the country. He's the author of 5 collections of poetry. His latest is one subject that Frank writes about frequently are African Americans in history. 2 of his books are about York, the slave who accompanied the Lewis and Clark expedition, for example. And his forthcoming book from the University of Georgia Press is about civil rights activist Medgar Evers. And we have some tape of Frank reading a poem from that collection from last year's Alabama Book Festival.
Both of them were history even before one pulled the trigger. Before I rocketed through the smoking barrel hidden in the honeysuckle. Before I tore through a man's back, shattered his family, a window, and tore through an inner wall. Before I bounced off of a refrigerator and a coffee pot. Before I landed at my destined point in history next to a watermelon. What was cruel was the irony, not the melon, not the man falling in slow motion, but the man squinting through the crosshairs, reducing the justice system to a small circle, praying that he not miss, then sending me to deliver a message as if the woman screaming in the dark or the children crying at her feet could ever believe a bullet was small enough to hit.
That's Frank X. Walker from Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, coming out later this year from University of Georgia Press.
For those who don't know, what exactly does the Poet Laureate do?
The Poet Laureate travels around the state of Kentucky giving readings, lectures, leading discussion groups with schools, libraries, book groups, civic groups, basically makes themselves available to talk about the importance of literature and literacy. So they get a little bit of a travel stipend, but a lot of it is really a labor of love. He's going to replace Maureen Moorhead, who's a Louisville poet who will be retiring from her post. I guess perhaps already has.
Yeah. Before we get to your special guest, a few events going on this weekend. The Dutch Clout installation artist at the Land of Tomorrow. What's that about?
Yeah. We have Bernard Smild from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam. He creates these really amazing ephemeral clouds inside and documents the process. And then, you know, they just last for kind of a second. Mm-hmm. He photographs them. So he's created one at Land of Tomorrow. Of course, we can't see it. It's already gone. But he's photographed it. And there'll be a very large scale photograph of this on display, in addition to a lot of other playful installations. This is really interesting. Sculptor and works a lot sort of with, you know, contrasts and contradictions in your environment.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That opens tonight, yeah.
Another Broadway series production coming to town. This one's very popular, Million Dollar Quartet.
Yeah, the Million Dollar Quartet is set in the 1956 jam session, a historic evening that actually happened where at Sun Studios in Memphis, at a Carl Perkins recording session that then unknown Jerry Lee Lewis was playing piano on, Elvis Presley shows up, Johnny Cash shows up, and they all sit around and jam. So it's basically a great excuse to listen to a lot of mid-50s early rock and roll. You know, there's a plot there, but it's really kind of all about the songs. The performers are all playing instruments live. So it's, you know, it's a fun time.
And last chance to see a Girlfriend at Actors Theater.
Yeah, another musical based on the Matthew Sweet record of the same name. This show has been wildly popular through its three-week run. I've heard pretty much universal mm-hmm. adoration for it. So if you're looking for something to do this weekend, have not seen Girlfriend at Actors Theater, everybody that I know that has seen it has loved it. I thought it was very charming as well.
And you can read Aaron's review at WFPL.org. Who's your special guest today?
I'm here with Matthew Roney. He's a Louisville native who left home for college and has come back with a solo exhibit after exhibiting all over the world. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
So you have an exhibit opening tonight at the Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft. You want to tell us a little bit about the installation?
Yeah, we brought a large-scale installation to the museum that's from about 2008 and also two other works, one from 2009 and one from 2012.
So mounting towards zenith mm-hmm. is descending and disappearing. Mm-hmm. Is that the subtitle? So tell me about this piece and the role that you play in it.
Well, it's a kind of model of the life cycle is the kind of the way that I see it. And the life cycle is, if it could be possible for it to be divided into two parts, the first part being a more structure, more trying to escape adolescence, take responsibility for your life, delve into self-discovery. And then the second half of this part of life would be your resisting and death, and trying to stay virile and vertical. So one half of the installation is kind of feminine side, more of a vessel, and the other side is more of an altar of phalluses.
Oh, okay, nice. So, mm-hmm. So and these are all handmade. Mm-hmm. There's I assume, a large emphasis on material since mm-hmm. it's at KMAC. Talk a little bit about the materials that you use.
I just use a lot of wood. I use a lot of fabric. I use metal. I use all sorts of different things. But I think for me, the important quality is just the time spent making and the kind of energy transference that occurs when you spend a lot of time working on something. Sometimes I refer to it as a kind of work as prayer.
Mm. So, and this exhibit is also running concurrently with another one that's opening this weekend at KMAC called Taking the S Out of Craft. I think that's a really interesting concept. Mm-hmm. And so where do you stand on the art and craft, sort of what many consider to be a kind of a false dichotomy?
I mean, to me, I don't really make much of a separation. I mean, I find almost all things have a great quality for contemplation. And so it's not a polemic that really is important to me. I don't see much difference between the high and low arts. So I think they're all kind of on equal playing field as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'm curious about the life cycle of your work so far. So you're a Louisville native, and up until I was reading about your work, up until about 2006, you were exhibiting all over the world, the 2004 Whitney Biennial, and with a certain style. And then you took a bit of a break and came back with kind of a stylistic, it took a different turn. Can you talk about that, about how your work's evolved and changed?
I don't think it's so much a stylistic change, although that's the surface component. But I think that the real delineation was just that I wanted to kind of move away from maybe a more subversive and that kind of work where it's more based on something taboo, and to go into a much more personal relationship to the necessity to experiment with imagination and creativity. So it's not so much, I mean, the style of what I did changed, but I think more so the context in which I tried to figure out what would make me happy about making works.
Did that manifest itself in a material way as well?
Yeah, I mean, I changed the materials that I used, but I think also the criteria in which I observed what I did and experienced why I wanted to make things is what changed. And so I went from maybe a more external way of making things, more interpreted, to maybe a more more about self-discovery, like to use the act of making works as a chance for self-discovery and to experiment with imagination and fantasy.
And so you perform with your installation?
Not all the time, but okay. I will for this piece that came back, and yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. What does that involve?
I call them activations, and I think that I envision it as a way to insert like a real earnestness into the work, to get a real sincerity and warmth. It's not often that you see an artist inside their own sculpture or something like that, and most of the time it's very inanimate and it's there for contemplation. And I feel like inserting the body maybe takes it from a more intellectual standpoint to maybe a more emotional and psychological standpoint in terms of the relation of the viewer to the work.
Yeah, when you inject performance into a piece of art, I think our relationship to it does change, from the viewer's point of view, does change. We're sort of forced to look at it from a human standpoint, and a human created this, not this is an object that you can objectify.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So do you come back to Louisville often?
Maybe a couple of times a year, maybe once or twice.
Has this? Do you exhibit here often, though?
Never.
No. Oh, this is your first one back. Wow, yeah. That's really exciting. Mm-hmm. So where did you? Go high school art training here? Young art training, or did you mostly?
I studied. I mean, my dad introduced me to Paul Fields, who's a sculptor who passed away some years ago, and I also studied with Abby Ward, who's a woman photographer. I don't even know if she still lives here, but. And then, of course, I went to DuPont Manual, and so I've been studying. This is all I know in my life is art. So,
well, you've
Kenny Von Rohen. I worked for him for a long time as well. So,
you've made a fantastic career out of it.
Maybe from the outside. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I mean, I think since you've left to go on to school and then on to New York, the Louisville arts scene continues to evolve and change. Mm-hmm. When you tell folks out in the art world, you know, when they ask where you're from and you say Louisville, what do you gather their impressions are of Louisville as an art town?
I think most people know Louisville. Most people my age, at least, know Louisville as like music, indie music, like Slant and stuff like that, like the music scene. That's how I feel that people, and maybe Hunter S. Thompson or something. But so, I'm working on trying to get people to know Louisville for Karam Deeb's deli.
Oh.
The Morris deli.
That's a good one. Good sandwiches there.
Yeah, good country ham.
Well, as somebody who grew up here in Louisville and was training as an artist and left, what do you feel Louisville could maybe do more of to train and encourage and nurture its young artists?
I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I think just keep on keeping on. Just, I don't know. I mean, I think having a place like KMAC is great, and I know that they've got a great new curator at the Speed, and I think, you know, I mean, it seems like it's on track. I mean, I think just see as much art as you can, maybe, you know, participate. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there.
Well, speaking of participating, Matthew's exhibit opens tonight at 5 p.m. You'll be performing,
mm-hmm.
and that's on the second floor gallery at KMAC on Main Street. The exhibit is open through May 5th, so hopefully everyone who's an old school Matthew Roney fan will come on out and check out the new work as well.
Thank you.
All right. Matthew Roney, welcome back to Louisville. And Aaron, thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information on topics discussed on Byline, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL news staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Laura Valentine is our intern. And I'm Rick Hellett. Have a great weekend.